We need bright ideas now. That was the title of a panel discussion and screening of Inconvenient Truth, held by the Vancouver Point Grey New Democratic Party at the Ridge Theater, February 12, 2007. All the speakers are available from www.ecoshock.org.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome. My name is Shane Koshaniak, and I'm president of the Vancouver Point Grey NDP, the organizers of this forum on climate change. On behalf of my constituency association, I welcome you to the Ridge Theatre, which is a generous co-sponsor of the forum. Other sponsors include Co-op Books, SPEC, the COPE 378 Union Local, and One Day, representing the City of Vancouver's Office of Sustainability. I thank also the numerous organizations that have advertised the forum on their listservs, particularly the Anglican Church. Point Grey NDP has staged the forum simply because we care about the environment. Environment, of course, is the foundation of quality of life. For several years now, we have tracked climate change as a critical issue. Indeed, the science of global warming has been solid for more than a decade. We have invited nonpartisan speakers because nobody should be deterred by politics from hearing the message, grasping the message that climate change is happening in BC and the world right now. Our first two panelists will inform you about the climate and economic consequences of taking no action. Reversing the effects of global warming will be the work of a generation. Each sector of society, industry, government, and citizens must do its fair share. The following three panelists will tell you what should and can be done in those areas. You've come here tonight to hear bright ideas for the planet now. So without further ado, I introduce to you Heather Harrison, our moderator for the panel, and the question and answer session to follow. Heather is a philosophy instructor at Kwantlen University College, where she teaches environmental ethics, business ethics, and critical thinking. Heather believes the importance of philosophy in a democratic society is that it empowers people to become responsible citizens. Heather has been a political activist for many years and ran in the 2005 Vancouver City election. Currently, she serves on the executives of Vision Vancouver and the provincial NDP. And so I hand it over to you, Heather.
I'm really honored this evening to introduce our panel of distinguished speakers. The first speaker we have this evening is Dr. Philip Austin. Dr. Austin earned his PhD in geophysics from the University of Washington in 1987 and is currently an associate professor in the Department of Earth Ocean Sciences at UBC, where he serves as an associate chair of the Atmospheric Sciences Program. He also spent a year as a National Research Council postdoctorate fellow in the Climate and Radiation Branch of NASA Goddard Space Flight Center before coming to UBC. He's a leader of the Cloud Aerosol Feedbacks and Climate Research Network, which is a four-year collaborative project involving researchers from UBC, McGill, the Université du Québec et Montréal, Dalhousie, and Environment Canada. Dr. Austin will be speaking on the climate effects of global warming. Welcome, Dr. Austin.
So could I have the first slide? So competing with the slideshow that's going to be shown tonight is almost impossible. But what I'd like to do is really take my 10 minutes and talk about two issues that I think we're ready to start a discussion on. As Heather mentioned, or Sean mentioned, the debate's been over on why climate is warming for about 10 years or so now. And for whatever reason, this movie is perhaps a big part of this. The problem really now has tipped, and I think we're looking at the next phase, which is to try and figure out what to do about it. And so before we do that, I think it's worthwhile looking a little bit at the science and asking a couple questions. And the two I want to cover in the 10 minutes that I've got are essentially this idea of dangerous interference, because this is going to be a topic that's going to be in conversations for the next 75 to 100 years, I think, as we try and avoid a warming of 2 degrees. And I just want to say a little bit about where that number comes from and why it would be prudent to try and keep the global temperature to within 10 degrees of what it was, 2 degrees of what it was pre-industrial. And then the second is, I think a lot of people, even if they are now sold on the idea that we actually are causing the warming that's observed, really this is a legitimate question. How can we predict temperatures in the year 2100 when we can't tell you whether it's going to rain next Friday? And so this, I think, is going to be a topic also for the next 50 to 100 years as we try and actually make regional forecasts in a changing environment. So for the next several centuries, no matter what we do right now, things are going to be changing, and we can control the throttle. We can certainly change the rate of change, but we're going to be grappling with a world that one decade to the next is a little bit different, and the models are going to be able to tell us some things and not others. And in particular, I'd like to introduce this idea of climate sensitivity, because this is the crucial thing that we need to know working forward in the next 30 years or so. So could I have the next slide? So this is this idea of dangerous interference. And really, to put this in perspective, you need to really look at the last 5 million years of climate. And so what we've got here is a sediment core going from 5.5 million years ago to the present. And you can see that 5 million years ago, it was 2 degrees warmer than it is currently. There was no ice in the Arctic. The Arctic Ocean was open. And there was no ice in Greenland, so that the sea level was 75 meters higher than it is currently. As the orbit of the Earth changed, the sunlight in the northern hemisphere decreased until, at about 3 million years ago, the Arctic froze and the Greenland ice sheet formed very rapidly. And at that point, then, you have this the beginning of the ice ages and this large oscillation between ice sheets that covered all the way down to 35 degrees latitude, and a planet that was about the same temperature as it is currently. So 2 degrees is a significant amount of warming. 2 degrees is the difference between ice-free pole and an ice-free Greenland and the world that we actually know. So if I could then focus on the next slide, which shows the last 500,000 years, and we've now moved this back to 650,000 years. This is the center point of Inconvenient Truth, and from a climate scientist's point of view, a huge contribution of this movie is the fact that Al Gore really walks you through this slide. And this is the CO2 record here in green. This is the temperature record in blue. And you don't have to be a climate scientist to, as Al Gore says, to think that these things are connected. And in fact, you can actually use the ice ages to investigate whether your model is working or not. And we can use the ice ages to determine the climate sensitivity. So what we really want to know from the climate models is, if we do double CO2, how much will the surface temperature increase? Will it increase 2 degrees, 3 degrees, 6 degrees? And again, 2 degrees and 3 degrees is the difference between an ice-free pole and a pole that actually has relatively normal sea levels. So if I could have the next slide. So this is the CO2 and the temperature record together. And you can see that they trend almost identically. And again, I don't think you could make this point often enough, which is that this is the present. Here's the last interglacial. This is a sea level that is 4 to 6 meters higher than it is at present. And this is about the same temperature as it is today, actually. And we had 280 parts per million of CO2. At the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. Today, we're actually beyond 370. We're at 380. There's probably no way we're going to stop below 450 parts per million. And if we burn coal, there's nothing stopping us really from hitting 1,000 parts per million. And so every time we double CO2, we actually double the problem, because the warming is, every time you double the concentration, you actually double the warming. So again, the take-home point from here is that 2 degrees is really a large amount of warming, and we're going to have to stop the CO2 concentrations before it gets much beyond current levels. And so the question is, how much? And if I could have the next slide. Now, this is from a very recent climate model run. This is the Goddard Institute for Space Sciences, coupled GCM, one of the best. And this addresses my second point, which is if you can't predict the weather for longer than 2 weeks, which you can't, it's impossible, how can you predict the climate in the year 2100? And you can see that climate is different from weather. These are five runs of the Goddard model, and it's not, there's no butterfly effect, right? The runs stay together, and that's because climate is fundamentally predictable, because it's forced on these long time scales. So this is 1880, this is 2000, and all five of these runs actually do an excellent job of predicting the current or the history of the surface temperature of the planet. So we're at the point now where we actually have capable models, and we can start asking them questions. And on this slide are all the different ways that we actually heat and cool the planet. The line here is the greenhouse warming. These spikes are volcanic eruptions. This is Pinatubo, and this is El Chichon, and this is Krakatoa. And again, each of these can be used to calibrate the model. But an ironic point is that we aren't feeling the full effect of the greenhouse gases that we've actually put into the atmosphere. First of all, because about half the heat has actually gone into the ocean. And we've got a pretty good handle on this now, and it's waiting to come out. So this is idea that even if we were able to magically turn CO2 off tomorrow, you aren't able to actually stop the warming. It'll come out through the oceans. But the other thing is that pollution here is doing an extraordinarily good job of cooling us off. And as we put stack scrubbers in, for example, in the coal-fired power plants, we're going to eliminate this cooling, and then that's going to actually make the greenhouse effect probably twice as bad. So the bottom line is that in this model, if you double CO2, you increase the surface temperature by 3 degrees, and that actually is not good. So that's more than 2 degrees. So my final slide then is this one. So this is from the most recent IPCC report. And here you've got three different scenarios for the future. The red one here is what I call letter rip, which is 15 billion people with sort of economic efficiencies of about today, burning everything they could get their hands on. So that's the red line here. And you can see on this trajectory at 2100, we are well above 4 degrees. So probably we lose the Greenland ice sheet in about 200 years. There is the business as usual, which is right here. But this is a trajectory called B2, a set of economic choices that we can make that actually stabilize the warming below 2 degrees. And so I'm sure the other speakers will talk more about this. I can address the spread in the models here, but my take-home point here is that there is actually a way to stabilize climate at 2 degrees. So if we have the will, then certainly the models indicate that that a solution is possible.
Thank you so much. Our next speaker is Dr. Bill Reese. Dr. Reese earned his PhD in population ecology from the University of Toronto and has taught at the University of British Columbia School of Community and Regional Planning since 1970, where he teaches the ecological basis for human development. He is the originator of the ecological footprint analysis and a founding member of the Canadian Society for Ecological Economic. The Vancouver Sun has described Dr. Rees as one of BC's top public intellectuals. And last year, Dr. Rees was elected as a Fellow of the Royal Society of Canada. Dr. Bill Rees will be speaking on the economic effects of climate change. Welcome, Dr. Rees.
Thank you very much, Heather. I'm actually going to talk mostly about something called the Stern Report, which some of you will know was an economic report to the British government released on October 30th of last year. This report is one of a string of reports from economists. If we can go to the next slide, please. It really starts from the basic science. In fact, there's no new science whatsoever in the Stern Report. And I'm going to sound a little bit cynical here, because despite the fact that there's no new science here, until the recent IPCC report, the Stern Report seems to have been more effective in waking people up to the reality of the problem, because it's money-based, than any of the science preceding. But just because it's an economist talking here doesn't mean there's any absolute truth in what Stern has to say. So I want to move back about a decade or more to what some previous economists have had to say about climate change. If we can move forward, please. Here are three quotes, all from very well-known papers from very prominent economists on climate change. They all have two things in common. The first is the totally incorrect assumption that agriculture is the only sector of the economy likely to be affected. The second is they agree that agriculture is only about 3% of gross domestic product, or gross world product, in fact. Now, when we look at that, look at the middle quote, because it really captures what the others two do as well. Since agriculture is only 3% of GDP, even if net output of agriculture falls by 50%, this is only a 1.5% cut in gross domestic product, in this case in Britain. The same is true in Canada or the United States. Notice the ludicrous assumption here that the world could sustain a loss of half of its food production when 2 billion people are already malnourished, and the only impact would be a 1.5% hit in GDP per capita. The Nordhaus quote preceding that makes exactly the same point and is an extremely influential economic report that has really shaped U.S. climate change. So we have to be a little bit careful in understanding what these earlier reports said, and it helps to shape our reaction to Stern. If we can go to the next slide. Well, we've already had some of these statistics. We know the present concentration of greenhouse, or the pre-industrial concentration. We know the present concentration in terms of carbon dioxide equivalents in parts per million. The main point is the middle bullet here. With likely increasing accelerating emissions, we could reach 550 parts per million CO2 equivalent by as early as 2035, which would bring a 77% chance of exceeding the 2-degree Celsius maximum temperature rise that Philip has indicated is really an extremely important number to keep in mind. A 77% chance of meeting this disastrous level of warming by just about 30 years from now. If we go to the next slide, pardon me, slide, please. Here are some of the impacts that Stern admits are likely to result from a slightly increased temperature beyond that 2-degree limit, which he says is probable, or at least likely. Major declines in crop yields over entire regions. Sea level rise threatening London, Shanghai, New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, Richmond, Cairo, and areas inhabited by 5% of the world's people. We will see refugees, about 350 million, if we take 5% of the 7 billion population that's likely to be on the planet by 2035. There was an article just last week in the Vancouver Sun showing that the RCMP are already looking at the consequences for Canada of having to deal with a huge increase in the number of immigrants. The collapse of the Amazon rainforest, possible collapse of the Gulf Stream, collapse of all the world's major glaciers and major flood risk. We've already heard about that with the rise in sea level. A loss of up to 40% of the world's species, major health epidemics, and so on. This is a short list of the likely consequences of a likely scenario over the rest of this century. What he concludes in the end is extremely important and vastly different from the conclusions of the previous economics reports that have had so much influence on policy just in the last decade. His minimal projection is that allowing things to proceed business as usual, the scenario we saw a moment ago, would result in as much as a 20% loss of GDP, much greater than the 1.5%. A minimal loss of GDP on the order of 5% is possible. He argues that with only 1% of GDP invested each year, the world can avoid these huger costs, and therefore the bottom line is that reducing the expected adverse impacts of climate change is both highly desirable and feasible. Tell that to our present government, who are not willing to spend a dime, really, on doing what is necessary to make the deep cuts necessary here. The other point I want to make is that the whole... The numbers in the Stern report, I won't even get into them because they're extremely suspect in the sense that one of the most difficult things to do is to estimate the real value of ecological impacts and intangibles in an increasingly chaotic world where we can't really well predict what the consequences are likely to be. Next slide, please. This is the really important one from the perspective of everyone in this room. To stabilize atmospheric greenhouse gas concentrations at between 500 and 550 parts per million, that's the level at which, beyond which more than 2 degree increase in temperature can be expected, will require a more than an 80% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. Everything we do, about 85 to 90% of the energy basis of techno-industrial society is currently derived from fossil fuels. In the next 35 to 50 years, we must abandon 80% or more of the fossil fuels we use to power our economies. And as a somewhat student of alternative energy, I can say that in total, the current technologies available to us as substitutes won't come close to replacing the dramatic decline in fossil fuels that we must begin to enter into if we're going to achieve the necessary target. In the short term, we must see a CO2 emissions peak within the next decade or so, highly unlikely given the trajectory that China and India are on. China brings a new power plant capable of powering a city the size of Vancouver every week to 10 days. And this is primitive coal-fired power technology because we won't sell them the technology necessary to make it clean technology. Talk about shooting ourselves in the foot. Recommended actions. Next slide, please. Here I think the report really gets soft because there's nothing here that we haven't heard 10,000 times before, and even here in these soft recommendations, not much is happening. We must reduce demand for emission-intensive goods and services. In other words, shift consumer behavior. Instruments here should include carbon taxes. The fact of the matter is that people respond to price increases. The only time in the history of humanity that per capita energy declined for a period of several years was between 1978, roughly, and 1983, and that was the period during the Arab oil embargo and the Iran war, during which time real prices rose for fossil fuels to higher levels than we're experiencing today. The effect was a dramatic decrease in per capita and therefore gross energy consumption. Notice the world did not fall apart. The result was the invention of the Honda Civic and other efficient technologies. Canada took the world lead in wind power technology. We quickly dropped it as soon as oil prices returned to quote-unquote normal, which means energy consumption once again began to go up. The main point is that every political party in Canada has sworn, now I may be wrong about the NDP on this one, but certainly both the Liberals and Conservatives have said, never will we have a carbon tax or resource depletion taxes in this country. That's precisely the most powerful tool in the current kit box of tools that would help us to reduce our carbon emissions. Let's move to the next slide very quickly. There has been a number of very strongly worded reactions to the Stern report. In general, there is concurrence, if reluctant concurrence. But the Stern report still hasn't dispelled deep denial. The Cato Institute in Washington, the American Enterprise Institute, are both dead set against it. In the case of the Cato Institute, they claim that the Stern Report flies in the face of academic literature on the subject, which finds that climate change would have only a moderately negative impact at best. There are as many economic gains associated with warming as there are economic costs. The American Enterprise Institute, very closely tied to the Cato Institute, has just been given a major award by the petroleum industry in the United States to pay scientists $10,000 to come forward to discredit the IPCC report and therefore the Stern document. My final slide is about our money-obsessed society. This is where my cynicism comes in here. It's interesting to me that scientists have been warning us for decades about the impending problem. Here's one from 1992 from the Union of Concerned Scientists. "We, the undersigned, senior members of the world scientific community, hereby warn all humanity of what lies ahead. A great change in our stewardship of the Earth and of the life on it is required if vast human misery is to be avoided and our global home on this planet is not to be irretrievably mutilated." That kind of warning has been repeated for a decade or more now with increasingly strident tones and falls on deaf ears, hardly reported in the newspapers. But as soon as somebody puts a money price on this, it's not good enough that we destroy the planet. But if we know that it costs several tens of trillions of dollars, then we pay attention. There's something wrong, it seems to me, with our value system when we only respond to the money charge. Thank you very much.
Our next speaker is Mr. Graham Kissick. Graham Kissick is the Director of Sustainability with Catalyst Paper Corporation based in Vancouver. He's worked as an environmental specialist in the pulp and paper industry for 15 years and focuses on air, reducing air, liquid, and solid waste emissions. He has a bachelor's in mechanical engineering and a master's in chemical engineering from UBC and an MBA from SFU. Mr. Kissick is involved with the WWF on the climate change issue, as well as numerous local groups on the Great Bear Rainforest. Mr. Kissick will discuss the role that industry can play in tackling climate change. Welcome, Mr. Kissick.
Thanks, Heather. If we actually go back to the title slide, please. Oh, there it is. Sorry. I included this quote because I thought it was fitting, and nobody's really talked about it tonight. And this, the quote by Aristotle here really captures the issue, and that is that we're facing today is really the tragedy of the commons, and that it's the atmosphere that is really owned by everybody, but is really owned by nobody when you consider it from a stewardship perspective. So I think it's a gem because it captures the issue we have today. Next slide, please. This is the latest data that the federal government has released on where Canada sits in terms of its carbon emissions relative to Kyoto. And you can see it is not at stellar performance by any means. In fact, we're 27% above the 1990 baseline. And, of course, we were shooting for 6% below by the first commitment period, which starts in 2008 to 2012. It's an embarrassing record. It's actually not the most embarrassing record on the planet, but it's embarrassing because, of course, in fact, the Americans did better than we did. They only increased their emissions by 16%, and, of course, they didn't even sign on to Kyoto. So what does it say for our programs? Next slide. This is also a snapshot from the federal government in terms of where those 758 million tons a year are coming from. And you can see the lion's share of those are coming from the energy end of our society. And I say energy end because it's not just businesses' energy, but it's your energy as well. Next slide. Just to focus on energy, somebody's already mentioned, I think it was Bill, the notion around dirty energy and what it can do to us. And the reality today is that the 6% reduction that Canada signed on with Kyoto and all the other signatories, the total reductions were those to be delivered by the first commitment period basically is about 480 million tons per year. Unfortunately, if you take either a very minimalist scenario or a more realistic scenario on all of the new coal-fired facilities that are coming online, especially in China, India, and the U.S., you can see that you quickly blow past those savings that Kyoto would have achieved. And, of course, the majority of the Kyoto signatories are not going to be able to deliver those savings, as evidenced by Canada. So we certainly have a challenge on our hands. Next slide. Just to dig a little bit further into the issue here, I represent big business in Canada. We openly admit that we are a major cause of the problem. We are polluters. We discharge great volumes, tonnages of carbon dioxide. Large final emitters are responsible for about 37% of Canada's greenhouse gas footprint, and you can see the breakdown there. About 44% of that comes from power utilities generating electricity for big business as well as consumers. The forest industry that I work in is included in the manufacturing sector there at 32%. The forest industry makes up probably about 4% of that 32% under manufacturing. So when we look at the situation that we're faced with today, I guess there's two takes on it. One, you can think, well, it's a great problem which can't be overcome, and you throw your arms up, or you say, well, hold on a sec, I think this represents opportunity. People in past have been creative, and we can do things. And so that's the way we look at things. We see great, great opportunity here to reduce emissions, but along with those reductions, also reduction in costs. And, of course, that's where large corporations and shareholders are very, very interested. We also see there's great opportunity for Canada to become a leader in new carbon control technology. This is an area of great, great opportunity today, and in the next couple decades will grow leaps and bounds. And then the final opportunity is defining new markets for technologies and products which haven't even been considered today. Next slide. So there's basically, as I see it, three different approaches to getting to the end point, which is essentially stabilizing the temperature, the global temperature in terms of carbon concentrations. And we heard and we'll probably hear more about the approaches tonight, and I wanted to touch on them very, very quickly. The first approach is the carrot. These are corporate and individual incentives to get organizations to act appropriately. And the warning I would give here is we need to do it properly. I have a very interesting example. Currently today, there's 5 wood pellet plants that operate throughout British Columbia that convert raw biomass energy into wood pellets, and they're railed down to the BC coast here. They're put onto deep sea vessels and they're sent through the Panama Canal into Europe, where they're burned to displace coal-fired electricity. Now, at the same time, British Columbia only gets about 90% of its power from hydroelectricity. The other 10% is purchased power from Alberta, which is coal-fired power. So how can it make sense sending all of that wood via fossil powered ships through the Panama when we have the problem on our doorstep? The stick approach is basically government creating strong regulation, carbon tax. That approach also works. It's very, very effective. It potentially stymies creativity. But the other thing we need to be aware of, and I think the current government has at least picked up this much, that you cannot disconnect air quality issues with climate change issues. You need to deal with them in whole. Otherwise, you may find you're impacting urban air quality for the sake of improving your carbon footprint. The real thing I want to talk about tonight is the voluntary action end of it. And we see great opportunity to continue to improve our company's performance on this front. And I thought I would share some of our experiences. But there are three hurdles that have to be overcome. The first is organizations have to start to recognize that there's actual opportunity when they undertake this sort of social responsibility. Secondly, capital markets have to start to reward organizations for taking this sort of approach. And the only way that will happen is if shareholders, mutual fund holders, tell those managers that we want ethical funds that look beyond the financial bottom line, that look at the triple bottom line. And thus far, we have yet to see that sort of behavior in the mainstream financial markets in North America. Finally, consumers need to start rewarding carbon leaders with buying behavior. Coming from the forest industry, I've seen so many times where organizations, companies come out with great ideas, recycle products, non-bleached paper products. They put them on the shelves and they do not move. Customers are fixed on the type of products they will buy. Next slide, please. There's a lot of companies that are actively involved in social responsibility. You can see them up there. Basically, it improves the company's profitability. It protects your brand. It augments your brand. It provides marketplace stability. A lot of these companies are doing that. I'm going to touch on one of them, and I've chosen actually probably the least liked of the group, and it's not Victoria's Secret. It's actually Walmart. If I have the next slide. Walmart have not behaved appropriately in the last decade, and I think they have figured that out in the last 12 months. Walmart has just launched a major sustainability initiative out of the U.S., which is going to cover all of their stores internationally. They estimate they can save about $3.4 billion a year with simple projects that improve the energy profile of their buildings, reduce the amount of packaging they're dealing with, that eliminates waste out of their stores. They are setting a major, major trend in the retail business, and so we're hopeful that that will filter through. Next slide, please. So Catalyst, we've been very lucky. We've been working with organizations we consider who are in the know for almost the last decade now. And folks like WWF Climate Group and Pembina help give us ideas that we act on. And so we've been able to move to cleaner fuels, to energy efficiency projects, to closing old infrastructure. I'm also excited to let the group know tonight that we're exploring sale of carbon neutral paper in 2007. I can't tell you who it's with yet, but it will be a first in our industry. Next slide. Just to let you know, it does work. We've managed to reduce our energy usage since 1990 by about 27%. Next slide. We've managed to reduce greenhouse gases by about 70% since 1990. And then the final slide. And so that's equivalent to about 250,000 cars being permanently taken off the road every year. So it's something that big business can do. And in doing this, we have saved an incredible amount of money in terms of energy costs. Thank you very much for your time.
Our next speaker is Ian Bruce. Mr. Ian Bruce is a geological engineer. Before working for the NGO sector, he worked for several years with industry as an environmental consultant and as a field geophysicist for a large offshore oil and gas exploration company in the world. Some of Ian's most recent accomplishments include developing and launching the Alpine Club of Canada's Melting Mountain Awareness Program, the first educational program on the impacts of climate change on mountain environments, and coordinating the David Suzuki Foundation Offshore Oil and Gas Program. Mr. Ian Bruce will discuss the role for government in tackling climate change. Welcome, Mr. Bruce.
Thanks, everybody. It's great to see such a good turnout tonight. Tonight, I hope a lot of people stick around for the movie. It's probably been one of the most profound changes we've seen throughout our society of mobilizing people and putting pressure on our governments to react to this emergency. Tonight, I've been asked to talk about government's role in addressing this problem, and specifically, I'm going to focus on a lot of the things we can do here in BC at the provincial level. And one of the reasons why is because we have a huge opportunity coming up in BC, because the BC government's coming up with a new energy plan. The kind of change that we need today that many of the speakers have talked about involved a really significant shift in our economy, shifting our economy from one that is quite polluting and wastes a lot of energy to one that's energy efficient, a cleaner economy, an economy for the 21st century. And because of this dramatic shift, the kind of change that we need today has to come from the government level. One of the reasons why is because governments have the opportunity to put in place the economic signals that are needed to put a cost on pollution, because that's one of the big problems we have today, is that right now it's free for most either companies or anyone to pollute into the atmosphere. So that's one of the significant things that we need to see happen. Governments have the ability to put this price signal in place by either limiting emissions, putting a limit and an eventual reduction on emissions, and also by putting a price, some of the speakers mentioned before, a carbon tax on emissions, which is a very, very powerful tool that we need to be using. One of the misconceptions about regulations, and we hear a lot of things about industry's reluctance about regulations, but one of the simple facts is that they're very, very effective. Regulations help stimulate innovation. They actually force companies to think differently, to help solve problems, and to put their efforts towards coming up with new technologies, such as cleaner vehicles, for example. Secondly, regulations also create economies of scale. And this is one of the most important things, is that it gets these technologies into use. It's no good just to innovate a product if it doesn't get out there and is being used by people and consumers and businesses. So that's one of the great things about regulations, is they create economies of scale where prices, these products get out there, there's enough of them made that prices drop and consumers can access them more easily. And a really good example of that is the hybrid vehicle. And the hybrid vehicle was developed in California because they passed regulations on vehicle emission standards back in the 1990s. And that's one of the technologies today where a hybrid vehicle, on average, can reduce greenhouse gas emissions by about 40% compared to an average car. So over the coming weeks in BC, our government's about to release a new energy plan, which will set energy development for the province for the next 10 to 20 years. The plan will significantly shape BC's direction in the development of a 21st century economy, and whether the province will be a global leader in the efforts to address global warming or if BC will be a laggard. Right now, BC's environment greenhouse gas emissions are about 30% above 1990 levels. The other reason why this plan is so vitally important, it really shouldn't be called only an energy plan. It's also our climate change plan, because over 80% of BC's greenhouse gas emissions will be influenced because of this plan. I'm going to talk about a few of the solutions available today, but one of the things we should know right now is here in the province of British Columbia what we have as far as a plan to address global warming. And one of the strengths that we have here in the province is that we've got the Agricultural Land Reserve, which is one of the really most effective tools in helping to curb urban sprawl and help address greenhouse gas emissions that way. Because one of the biggest sources of emissions in our province is, it depends on where you live and it depends on how you get around, for example, getting to and from work. So that's one of the big things that is very effective. Some of the weaknesses are that we do not have any targets at all to reduce emissions here in the province, overall greenhouse gas emissions, absolute emissions. As well, the province has recently awarded two contracts for coal-fired power plants that will more than double BC's greenhouse gas emissions from the electricity sector alone. And there's been a real focus on expanding freeways versus investing in public transit. And this is one of the things I want to talk about a bit more in a minute here. And the last thing is a lack of policies to cut emissions from the oil and gas sector and from the transportation sector in general. So a lack of regulation. But one of the things, some of the solutions that are available to us today are things like implementing California's vehicle emission standard here in the province so that all of our vehicles would be about 25% more fuel efficient. Secondly, instead of risking billions of dollars in expanding freeways, such as the Portman Freeway, to take that investment and invest it in public transit. And the reason why I say this is that unlike a light bulb or a car or any of these other products that we use, a transportation highway infrastructure, it doesn't last just decades, it lasts centuries. And if you make the mistake of putting in an inefficient transportation system, it takes away our ability to reduce emissions elsewhere. And this is the fundamental, one of the fundamental reasons why I think that the Gateway Program and the Portman Highway expansion is so vital in the fight against global warming here in the province is because of the increase in we make the area, the region more car dependent. It stimulates more people to encourages people to drive more and use their car more, and it reduces the solutions and actually takes away the effectiveness of putting in public transit in the future. It makes it absolutely economically less feasible to put in those solutions later on. So these are some of the things that we could be doing is we currently don't have a long-term provincial funding for public transportation, and that's something we should definitely push for. The other thing that the province could easily do is on electricity, and that is shifting towards pushing for 100% clean, renewable energy for our new electricity demand. BC has got one of the best resources in the world for wind power, yet today we don't have a single wind turbine operating, although there have been several contracts recently awarded. So we're moving forward. But I guess the point being is that we've just scratched the surface on some of these new technologies. We should be pushing forward with policies such as this to expand the use of solar thermal energy on homes and housing developments, and as well as aggressive conservation efforts to reduce electricity demand here in the province. The other thing we can do here as far as the provincial government goes, one thing that's really important is improving our efficiency standards for new appliances such as fridges, improving the efficiency standards of buildings and homes to make them more energy efficient, better insulated, and have these requirements set out for the industry. But before I end here tonight, I really want to also focus on what we can do as citizens. And certainly we all have a responsibility to reduce emissions in our own lives by buying energy-efficient products, by choosing sustainable transportation options when we get to and from work, for example. But by far the most powerful thing we can do is how we act as citizens. And that, what I mean when I say that is, as Canadians, as British Columbians, as Vancouverites, we can vote for people who can take strong action on climate change and who support the policies that will make the real difference. We can do this by exercising our rights as citizens, by contacting or calling our political leaders directly. And I have a little handout that I'll pass around for people on how you can contact your local government representative. But politicians gauge, for example, every letter they receive, it reflects the political weight of about 500 to 1,000 people. For every letter they receive, to them, that reflects the views of about 1,000 British Columbians. Now, here tonight, we've got about 450 people in the audience. If everyone here tonight was to write Gordon Campbell and NDP leader Carol James over the next week and advocate for stronger action on global warming, and we've got some examples here of some of the things you can mention, but that would carry the weight of over 200,000 British Columbians as far as their terms. And I think that would be a tremendous success for us tonight on how we can address this problem. Please remember, after the movie tonight, what matters is what we do as citizens when we leave this building. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much. Our next speaker is Mr. Dan Rogers. Mr. Rogers is a graduate of law school at the University of Alberta. During his time in Alberta, he was involved in environmental legal issues, and he served as the chair of the CBA environmental section. He's active in local civic politics as well as community activism, and he's been a member of the board of directors of the Society Promoting Environmental Conservation since 2003.
Yay. Just feels like
and he currently serves as president. Mr. Rogers will help tackle the question of personal action in dealing with climate change. Welcome.
Thanks, Heather, and I've also been asked to announce that this being an NDP function, that there'll be a committee on gender parity on all future environmental panels in the future. Anyway, good evening, and I'm here to talk about personal action, and as it says up there, which I was thinking about. I thought, what can I subtitle that? And I thought, well, it's all about me, but all about me has sort of two connotations. There's it's all about me, or it's the, oh my God, it's all about me. And I think we're sort of talking about all of us together, talking about the fact that we're all in this boat together, as we've talked about. Can I have the next slide, please? SPEC was formed in 1969, and its mission is to educate and empower citizens to build healthy, livable cities. And in keeping with that mission, I'm going to talk to you about effectively two things. What can you do in your own home and your business to slow the rate of climate change? What can you do as a citizen advocate in terms of to get your governments working in the right direction? With that in mind, I have two messages and then five brief topics to talk to you about. The first message is that really what we're talking about here, when you boil everything down to all of this, is that it's all about consumption. And so if we want to make a difference, each of us has to examine our consumption choices, either as a society or as an individual, of food, energy, land, space, air, water, you name it. It's all effectively about consumption when you boil it down. And my second message is that the key for recognizing, in my view, for individuals that can make a huge difference is if they adopt that belief that I talked about, which is that it's about me. It's not just about somebody else. We've heard about, the problems that have been created, and you will hear more about it as we get into the movie tonight about the tremendous challenge that's being faced. But it's not just about other people, it's also about us. Citizens, in my view, are way ahead of the government. They're way ahead of the curve in terms of where our government is going, and ahead of many of our industrial leaders. The citizens are ready for change. But being ready also means not just somebody else changing, it means all of us changing. And we have to keep this issue at the forefront of the agenda, both with the media and the governments. More about that in a moment. I actually heard somebody on the radio, a political pundit this morning, talking about the forthcoming federal election and positing, well, what would be the case if the climate portfolio was off the table by then and it wasn't really an issue in the government in the election? And I thought, these people just don't get it. It's not about a short-term fix. It's about the future. And it's always going to be on the table. We have to do more ourselves. We have to demand that our industrial leaders do more. And we have to demand that our governments and our elected officials do far more. And in this case, more means less. Can I have the next slide, please? So this is just a brief graphic that shows you that really there are greenhouse gas emissions associated with nearly everything we do. So we need to choose strategically about how to focus our programs to give people practical solutions. That's what SPEC has to do, and each of us has to focus our activities and our choices and our consumption models to reduce greenhouse gases. Can I have the next slide, please? This is a graphic that shows, on average, where personal greenhouse gases for everybody in Canada comes from. And you can see that a full half of the greenhouse gases come from transportation, passenger road transportation. There are other large categories, including space heating and cooling in your home. Those make up the largest part. If transportation of goods isn't included in this graph, what's interesting is that it also represents an enormous part of the regional greenhouse gases in Vancouver. And if you incorporated all of the greenhouse gases from personal transportation and then all of the greenhouse gases from transportation of goods, that would, in the Lower Mainland, that would account for 44% of the greenhouse gases in the Lower Mainland. And that is a large, large proportion. That includes all the industrial emitters. The way we use energy, the products we consume, and how we deal with our waste all influence our personal gas footprints. The good news is that there are some easy ways to reduce our footprints. Can I have the next slide, please? So the first of the five topics is transportation. And Ian already talked a little bit about the fact that one of the things we need to do is to ensure that our elected officials choose transportation alternatives that make sense. And it makes absolutely no sense to push and create transportation regimes and alternatives that are carbon fuel based, such as the Gateway Project. They make absolutely no sense. They'll become dinosaurs within 5 years, and they'll only make the problem far worse. So one of the things we can do is to ensure that message gets to our elected officials. Also, that means that there have to be alternatives, however. So one of the alternatives we also have to do is to advocate and work for transportation alternatives that make sense, that are accessible and affordable and provide for regional fairness. Next slide, please. As an individual, however, there are obviously some choices that you can make. You can look at alternatives. You can examine your own transportation mix of walking, cycling, transit, carpooling, driving, and flying. You can demand greater fuel efficiency in vehicles. I read an article in the paper about a week and a half ago that stunned me that even in this day and age, that when the Car Sellers Association or someone like that did a study of what were the top 27 factors in people's choices in choosing cars, fuel efficiency ranked number 23. Which in this day and age is unbelievable, you know, it's incredible. And so each of us can make a personal choice to move that far up the scale, to make that a choice that, and that next year when we're talking to you, it's in the, at least in the top 10. We can also, as I said earlier, we can look at, we can be involved in demanding stable and adequate funding for public, transit. Next slide, please. Ian also talked a little bit about land use issues. And sometimes the discussion around land use focuses on the fact that agricultural land is going to be lost. And that's an important factor when I talk a little bit further about the fact that one of my other messages is to buy local. We won't be able to refocus our economic models to ensure that we can buy our products and supplies locally if we put all of our agricultural land or large portions of it into transportation or other industrial uses. We have to support the types of protections for agricultural land use And also, of course, we have to ensure that our governments are focusing on and encouraging the smart growth principles around urban development. There's been a tremendous amount of work that's been done in this community, this region, around smart growth and the livable region strategy, and a lot of it will go down the drain unless the unchecked sprawl that could occur in parts of the Lower Mainland is not brought under control, and that again goes back to government planning. Next slide, please. We can each make choices around renewable energy, and there are many examples, and you can go to many organizations' websites, including SPECT, for many ideas around that. Some of them are to just reduce your demand for electricity and energy choices. Turn your thermostat down. Make sure your home is insulated properly. Use fluorescent light bulbs. There's many, many options available to you in order to reduce your energy bill. There's also renewable energy choices around solar hot water heaters that are available. Please check out our website for some options on those things. Next slide, please. Waste management. This is the old three R's, but you can reduce the amount of energy you use simply by recycling or simply reducing your consumption. And we offer that as an alternative for you once you decide you're going to. Is something, when you're going to buy something, ask yourself some questions. Will it simply be trucked or carried to a dump site? Or is it something capable of remanufacturing? Or can I do it without it altogether? And then the last item I want to touch on, and we've heard much in the media about this, is the issue around food sources. Look at your food choices. You've heard there's been a lot of media around this 100-mile diet that's coming. A suggestion we have is that you look for food alternatives that are close at hand and allow you to ensure that the greenhouse gases that are being produced in the shipping of the foods are not so great. I have a quick few slides just to give you some examples. For example, the next one. We see that an Ecuadorian banana comes in 10,000 kilometers by boat and produces more greenhouse gases than the pound of food. And the next slide, please, as a kiwi is the same. It's coming 13,000 kilometers, often by air, producing 60 times its weight in greenhouse gases. The point is that you can ask questions, you can make decisions around the products you produce, including the food you produce. What I would end is to say this is look for ways to reduce, buy locally, and get active. Thank you very much.
We need bright ideas now. That was the title of a panel discussion and screening of Inconvenient Truth held by the Vancouver Point Grey New Democratic Party at the Ridge Theatre, February 12, 2007. All the speakers are available from www.ecoshock.org.